Welcome to the 9th episode of Transit, the podcast on migration history at the Department of Contemporary History at the University of Vienna. My name is Franziska Lamp, and together with my colleague Philipp Strobel, we've created this podcast to talk to experts from the field about historical perspectives on migration, flight, and displacement. Today's guest is Lorraine McAvoy, who is a PhD scholar researching at Trinity College Dublin, where she has been funded by Trinity's Usher Fellowship and the Irish Research Council. Her PhD focuses on temporary transnational hospitality schemes or recuperative holidays for children in the immediate post-World War II period. For her research, she has visited various different archives, not only online and in Ireland, but also in Britain, Switzerland, Germany, and the Netherlands. She is also a member of the history team at the Museum of Childhood Ireland. In the first half of 2023, she was a junior research fellow at the NIOD, the Institute for War, Holocaust and Genocide Studies in Amsterdam. Now, Lorraine McAvoy, I'm really happy to have you here today as a guest into the 9th episode of Transit.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you. Let's just start off with the first question. So in your doctoral thesis, you work on recuperative holidays for children in the post-war period. What do you argue were the main motivations for relief programs for children who survived the Second World War?
Yeah, so humanitarian motivation is a very complex thing to unpick. There's so many different factors to consider, and it's different for governments, non-governmental organizations, and individuals. There's so many parties with their own sets of concerns. And I suppose I should clarify first, with my topic, there's so many different people involved. These are schemes that I study involved bringing children from one country to another, usually for three to six months. Sometimes schemes were longer to recuperate in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. And often they spent time with foster families in the host country as well. And there's so many different aid workers and different groups involved in getting these schemes off the ground. And they all have their own sets of motivations. And what I tend to do is take this idea of the humanitarian impulse that we've all heard and break it down. And I would say it's the intersection of different factors such as past experiences, prejudices, practicalities, emotional responses to the plight of certain groups, the media that people encounter. Motivations can be very political. They can be based on a sense of Christian duty, a responsibility to act, a moral obligation. With children after the Second World War specifically, there's a real concern about the impact of war on the minds of children, on their psychologies. And this feeds into fears about the future of civilization, which Tara Zahr and others have talked so much about. And in trying to ameliorate the impacts of this war, people did, you know, engage in these humanitarian hospitality schemes. They wanted to foster friendship between the children of different countries to ensure peace in the future, but they also wanted to supplant negative wartime experiences and traumas with a more positive post-war experience. So that's one motivation there. And I suppose what interests me isn't just what motivates people to undertake humanitarianism, but how they determine what form that humanitarianism will take. So will they send parcels, donate money? Do they want to take in children? And a lot of the time you see that people who want to take in children, they want to see that their humanitarian work is making a difference, because you can see it on the ground when you take in the children. And oftentimes, it's as much about the people providing the aid as those receiving it. You know, there's different factors. For example, you get letters to the government in the post-war period, to the British government, from people who fear the consequences of starvation in Germany, and they want to take in German children to their homes temporarily to ease that anxiety. And there's a slight tendency, I think, to fall into the trap of labeling humanitarian motivation as good or bad, you know, measuring them against this ideal type of neutral impartiality that we would associate with Red Cross principles. But I think it's the blurring that's interesting, the kind of the nexus of factors that make up the humanitarian impulse. And I'm not really sure you can properly disentangle that, but you can identify the different factors. And really, this is because people are complex and confusing, and there's differences between motivations and the articulation of those motivations. For example, between the advertising and the appealing and the roots of the desire to do so. So actually unpicking that and labeling it is quite different. I don't know if that gives an answer. I could keep going.
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you so much. Maybe now we're already so much into the topic. Could you give some examples so that our audience can like visualize that better, what you just told us? Like examples of such relief schemes in post-war Britain, Ireland, continental Europe?
These schemes occur throughout Europe. Switzerland and Sweden are particularly active. Spain developed a scheme and offered to take in children from many countries, but most turned them down. Ireland were active, so were the UK. And there's different scales of operation throughout the continent. And one thing to bear in mind is it's not always a thing of the countries that receive children and the countries that send children. So, you know, some British children go to Switzerland, the Netherlands towards the end of the war and into the post-war period sent thousands of children throughout to different countries. But then as the country begins to recover, they start to welcome children from Germany, Austria and Hungary, albeit in smaller numbers. And what I'm kind of doing is working towards a transnational approach. So these are inherently transnational schemes. They involve children going from one country to the other. So what I'm trying to do is I'm looking at them in five different countries to get the entanglements and the intersections and the comparisons between them. So what I think is like, if you have a transnational phenomenon, to get a genuinely transnational look at it, you have to look at more than one receiving and sending country. One scheme I'm particularly interested in is one that actually failed in Britain in 1945. And I think we can learn a lot, not more, but a lot from schemes that failed because there's so much rationalization around them and so much fighting to get them off the ground. And this one that I'm going to talk about is, it was developed by a man called the Air Vice Marshal Hugh Champion de Crespigny, and he set up this organization, Children of Europe Air Rescue. And they were set up around the autumn winter of 1945. And what they wanted to do was take about 10,000 children from Germany to the UK so that they would avoid starvation in the harsh German winter. And this was proposed as a scheme that would encourage international goodwill. It would save the children from starvation. But it's also interesting because there were a number of other reasons, such as that the Royal Air Force would be involved in the transport of the children, and it would help to salve the conscience of those who had been involved in the bombing of Germany. So this idea of a sense of moral responsibility, even on the Allied side, and humanitarianism as a way to ease that conscience. And this was also to expand to a broader public. But then when this scheme gets out, it's debated in depth by the British government and also in the press, and people write letters to the government explaining, you know, their reasons for wanting to help German children or not help them. And it's interesting because people either had to rationalize their desire to help Germans or their desire or the reluctance not to help children. So there's this kind of distinction. And you have flip sides to the same emotional responses. For example, some people fear helping Germany because they would be building up the next German army. There's all these stories of when Norway was invaded in 1940, that a fifth column was formed by children who'd been welcomed there, German children, after the First World War and similar schemes. But then on the other hand, you have people who fear the consequences of another harsh treaty like Versailles, another harsh peace. You know, do you want these children to grow up to be like their fathers? We have to take a different tack. So I find that scheme and its failure and all of the debates around it particularly interesting. And it also sheds light on broader schemes for German children in this period, because it reaches, you know, Ireland, who are developing their own scheme as well. But I won't go into too much on that.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really liked your explanation of this. Yeah, these processes of rationalization that you discovered in the discourse on relief programs for children. Now, you talked about rationalization in the discourses on these programs. For your research, the approach of emotional history or the history of emotions is really important. Maybe you could tell our listeners what you understand under this approach and how you use it and how you use the methods that go along with it in your research.
Yeah, so the history of emotions is a very rich and rewarding field. It has its origins in this period itself, in the Second World War, with Lucien Lefebvre's 1941 call for, for people to write the history of hate, of fear, of cruelty and love. And I find it very interesting, and there's some great work like Frank Bisson, angst in the Federal Republic. But I'm not sure my approach to emotions falls in with that kind of rigorous framework. It's more so that what I'm trying to do is understand a past that is so full of emotions that you can't not engage with it in the sense of an emotional history of post-war Europe. So I don't study fear or angst or hope as the explicit aims of my research, and they don't run in that way. But what I'm trying to do is get at, dissecting this humanitarian impulse and how people respond to it, how those who provide this aid and those who receive it respond, how they interact with each other, and all the connections. And it's very hard to do that without engaging with emotions. That's how people articulate how they're dealing with these times, how they want to help people. They talk about fear of the future, anxiety about the emerging Cold War and wanting to save German children, wanting to foster friendship because they have hope for the future, but also they fear potential futures where children aren't, exposed to different ideas. So really it comes down to the language and the relationship between the way we see the world and articulate the world and emotion. So this is a history that's full of pity, sorrow, guilt, responsibility, empathy, and fear, but it's not a history that is about those emotions. So it's a useful tool for me. It's a reality, it's a lens, but I don't view this period through an emotion-based framework.
Yeah, thank you very much. You are, of course, a historian and you are taught as a historian. Nonetheless, I wanted to ask you a question that corresponds more to nowadays, to modern times. How would you say do the special needs of children who survived World War II correspond to needs of children who survive conflict and war disaster today?
Yeah, it's such a wonderful and important question. As academics, especially in the arts, I think we're always talking about impact and the relevance of our work. I find, given the topic I work on, it's often quite saddening that I seldom have to explain its relevance. People often tell me how relevant it is and give me all these examples. There's such an abundance of need and so many different forms that it takes for children in the world today. I suppose there's overlapping experiences between children in the past and in now. There's actually, if people are interested, a great video, I think it's on YouTube, that the Society for the History of Children and Youth published from a workshop on children in crisis in 2022 with a lot of experts who have far more experience than me. So that's a worthwhile one on that question. But to give an overview, there's children have in common, most sadly, the loss of life, the loss of their homes, family members, and communities. Displacement is a huge issue, both children who are displaced with their families and also those who are forcefully and consequentially separated from their families. Children also experience violence. They have to witness violence and deal with that as well. And I'm not sure that we can assess the impact of these things on children today through our understanding and our reading of past experiences. I don't think we can directly translate how child survivors of the Holocaust or other wars and crises in the past, how they've coped with it. I don't know how well that translates to how the children of today will deal with these things and cope with them. But I think what we can do through understanding the past and the impact of past wars on children is it teaches us how much depends on individual experiences, on specific contexts, communities, and networks. The past can help us avoid that idea of the danger of the single story that Chimamanda Adichie talks about. And it can show us the complexities of what it means for children to be vulnerable, but also to be resilient, and how much actually goes into that in the course of a life. And I think the past can also show us how subjective and complex ideas of the best interests of the children actually are. And I think really what we can get from the relationship between the past and the present is a real sense of the complexity of the learning curves and how important it is to be honest about our own motivations and our own limitations when we deal with children who have to go through these experiences. And also the importance of listening to children's voices when they're children and not just when they're interesting historical subjects.
Yeah, thank you so much. Now I'm moving to our last question, which does not focus so much on the research on your thesis and other works of yours, but on your work as a member of the history team at the Museum of Childhood Ireland. Could you tell a bit more about the museum itself and what you do there, concepts that you tackle there?
Thanks. Yeah, the museum is a project that's very close to my heart. So really what the museum tries to do is provide a space to explore the past, present and potential of childhood and youth in Ireland, but also broader afield. At the moment, we're mostly based online with pop-ups here and there and kind of working towards a permanent home. And the real ethos of the museum is that children should be seen and they should be heard. There's so many great people involved across different disciplines, academics, practitioners, members of the public who aren't involved in that way. And I would recommend taking a look at the website, themuseumofchildhood.ie, for a broader overview of what we do. And we're on all the social media. But really, it's a space for conversations between the past and present, between generations and between disciplines. You know, it's not nostalgia driven. We do tackle difficult parts of our national history and the history of childhood more broadly, such as institutional care and historical abuse of children. There's a big focus on giving space to all versions of childhood in Ireland and abroad, a big focus on, you know, diaspora communities and the different versions of Irish childhood. For Culture Night this year, which is an event around September every year in Ireland, we did a talk on children in the move in the on the move in the past and present, and we brought people from history, law and the social sciences together to kind of talk about the implications and how we can best work together to understand what's going on today through the past and in dialogue with each other. And really the thing that I like most about the museum is the effort that is taken to put children and youth, not just young children, you know, teenagers are important too, youth as a whole spectrum, to put them at the centre. And they're currently working to put together a children's advisory team to inform the development and running an organisation of the museum, which I think is great. And what we should also be doing in our histories, you know, listening to children's voices.
Yeah, thank you so much for pointing out what the museum already has to offer and what are the next plans and what we can expect of the Museum of Childhood Ireland. Yeah, thank you so much, Lauren McEvoy, for speaking to me about your research, for answering all my questions. I think it was really an amazing episode we recorded today. Yeah, thank you for being here.
Thanks very much. It was an absolute pleasure.
Also, many thanks to our audience for listening to this podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to share it with your friends and colleagues. If you have any comments or questions regarding the podcast, you can reach out to us via the podcast platform you're using right now or contact us via our email, which is transit.zeitgeschichte@univ.ac.at. This was Franziska Lamp, today's host of Transit, the podcast on migration history. Until next time.